Welcome to Cybersecurity Where You Are, the Center for Internet Security's podcast. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO at CIS.
And I'm Tony Sager, Senior Vice President and Chief Evangelist at CIS. Cybersecurity affects us all, whether we're online at home, managing a company, supporting clients, or running a state or local government.
So join us on Wednesdays as we discuss trends and threats, explore security best practices, and interview experts in the industry.
Together, we'll clarify these issues, creating confidence in the connected world.
Hello, and welcome to the show, Cybersecurity Where You Are. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO here at the Center for Internet Security, joined by Associate Hybrid Threat Intelligence Analyst Ryan Davis. Ryan, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Doing well, thank you. And also Timothy Davis, Lead Analyst with our Cyber Threat Intelligence Group. Tim, how are you?
I'm good, Sean. It's great to be back on.
Fantastic. We have a very in-depth show, very timely, where we're now going to discuss some open source large language models, those that AFForeign developed, and again, moving into some elements with DeepSeek and DeepSeek R1. And representatively, you know, does that have any security considerations? What should we be doing in terms of evaluation and utilization of such an LLM? So a lot in this episode to cover. So, Tim, let me start off with a question. We're talking about, obviously, foreign-developed open-source large language models. Really, as we start to engage with those and representatively, just a couple of weeks ago, we saw a repercussion of the release of this capability, you know, a $1 billion devaluation necessarily in the tech markets representatively. But is there something we should be doing both individually and maybe from an enterprise perspective before we start deploying or even signing up for such services? Any thoughts in that space?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think what's really important here is for organizations to exercise caution, not just with a foreign-backed or a foreign-developed LLM, but really with any software. You know, it is one of the core principles that we talk to our members about all the time is exercising that level of caution when you're introducing new software into your system. One of the things to consider with DeepSeek, this Chinese AI in particular, is that it collects a lot of different types of data, including personal data, you know, your email address, your date of birth, your phone number, device data like keystroke patterns or rhythms, IP addresses, device models, operating systems, just a huge amount of data. And while the collection of the data itself is something to be concerned about, we also need to be concerned about where that data is actually being housed. DeepSeek is a Chinese-owned company. Its servers are housed in China. They are subject to the national intelligence laws of the Chinese government that allows them to access the data that is on those servers. Chinese cyber threat actors have a demonstrated pattern of conducting cyber espionage attacks against the United States. Just look at the headlines from the past month. They were dealing with Chinese cyber threat actors inside our telecommunications network. We started off last year with Chinese cyber threat actors inside our critical infrastructure, lying in wait to shut it down in the event of a conflict. So you have an adversary that clearly has a stated interest in discovering as much about us as they can and positioning themselves for a future conflict. And now throw into that one of, at the time anyway, one of the most popular apps in the world that houses all of that data on Chinese servers where the Chinese government can access it. That should be a huge concern to a lot of organizations out there. Is your data something you want the Chinese to have? And I know we'll get into this later in the podcast as well, but there have also been some pretty serious security risks with this new software that's coming out there. And the last thing I'll add here is open source doesn't always mean it's good. Just because we say it's open source and people have looked at it, I know, you know, when I was coming up in middle school and high school, we were always told not to use Wikipedia because that was open source and anyone in the world could go and edit it. Little different world nowadays, but just because everyone's reviewed the code, that doesn't change the underlying fact that your data is being stored overseas. It's accessible by a foreign government that is not exactly our friend right now. And that's something all organizations need to be aware of.
No, excellent points, Tim. And Ryan, it, you know, leads us down certain paths of both security considerations and really assessing risk from an organizational perspective about whether, so necessarily, oh, we've reviewed the code. We believe it's secure. We believe that there's capabilities that are conducive to its integration into a particular tool, product, service, whatever it happens to be. But what are some of the cautions in that space? And similar to elements that Tim has mentioned, but anything else that you would add there, Ryan, as we start to really dive into the consequences necessarily of the utility of such a capability?
Yeah, so it's really important to always be cautious when you're integrating any new system. And again, as Tim mentioned, especially one controlled by a foreign adversary. And I will say, too, you want to look at what security issues in terms of cyber vulnerabilities there are in whatever new system that you're looking to integrate. There've already been, as Tim alluded to, some security issues with DeepSeek. You know, on January 27th, the same day that all the news came out about DeepSeek overtaking ChatGPT in the App Store, the company indicated that it had to temporarily halt new user registrations after experiencing a large-scale malicious attack. You know, and cyber threat actors likely opportunistically targeted DeepSeek to take advantage of all of that heightened media attention and the increased user signups. And then a couple days later, you know, researchers from a cloud security company also revealed that they had found a publicly accessible DeepSeek database that exposed over 1 million records containing sensitive data. On top of that, several researchers from several different organizations have indicated that DeepSeek appears to lack protections against the generation of harmful content and that the model appears highly susceptible to jailbreaking techniques. And this is concerning because threat actors across the threat landscape are experimenting with generative AI to enhance their operations. So having effective guardrails is incredibly important. And I think it's important to note here, too, that AI platforms especially are treasure troves of data that a wide range of malicious actors are going to be looking to exploit and take advantage of. I mean, you have cyber criminals who are looking to sell personally identifiable information on the dark web. You have state-sponsored cyber espionage actors that are going after that proprietary data, information on specific individuals, and whatever other information they're looking to collect to further their national security priorities and their strategies. You have threat actors that are looking to abuse the platforms to generate malicious content or for other illicit activities. So it really is such a high value target. And so again, it's important to look at security considerations and vulnerabilities for any new application, but especially for something like an AI model that really is such a treasure trove of data.
No, I think, one of the things that pops into my head is kind of the multidimensional aspects of this, because not only are we integrating it like, you know, software into a product or service, but also its generation. And you mentioned, you know, elements of potentially toxicity of certain responses through prompt. And also, as you mentioned, jailbreaking through prompt engineering elements. And it may not have the same controls and conditions that we'd seen with, you know, ethical engines that have integrated into other models. And then respectfully, when we're thinking about this too, you know, you hit on a ton of elements, Tim, that are really, really important. Data handling and storage, the integrity of that model, the security posture of that model, both integrating it as a capability and its utilization, and then ultimately what you're seeing in terms of both the intelligence and adversarial elements. Tim, is this changing the game necessarily in the space in terms of we'd seen what we could do with, let's say, you know, the competitive ChatGPT? Now that that's been open source, now there's not necessarily the same guardrails. Is this an evolution necessarily in the space for adversarial tactics and techniques?
I'm not sure I'd call it an evolution. I mean, we have seen before how there have been jailbroken versions of ChatGPT released online. Their ability to actually produce malicious content's a little bit in question. There have been a couple customer complaints about them that the fraudsters may have actually been on a platform that was fraud itself. So I'm not sure this is a game changer. What's really a game changer here is that the release of this, which shocked the world that Monday morning, it really did remind people that this is a competitive field. AI is not a one-party game. You know, the United States is not the only player in this field. And China came out in a big way with this model. Now, how much of this model was them stealing or borrowing OpenAI's prompts and all of that and the true cost? That's all up for debate. But the bottom line is they did make something and they released it to the world. And when we're thinking about adversaries using it, it's also important to understand the context, again, in this geopolitical chess game that we play. The 2024 annual threat assessment from the U.S. intelligence community did note that China wants to become a superpower, and China has a vested interest in undermining U.S. democracy, in sowing doubts about U.S. leadership. And one lens to look at the release of this application is through that assessment. When you're thinking through how China could be doing that and what steps they're taking to implement that, you can't help but look at something like this application. It may be in China's best interest to simply not put restrictions on this platform, to allow it to generate malicious content, and for users to use it in ways that you can't necessarily use OpenAI's ChatGPT for something like that, at least not easily, with the goal here of undermining U.S. leadership, undermining democracy. And finally, you can't ignore the propaganda aspect of things like this, like DeepSeek, like Red Note that came out. You know, you have to remember, you are using an app owned by a foreign government that is very big into censorship and very big into painting the United States as the bad guy in every single aspect of the world. So you're going to see things through that very heavily censored lens and this very pro-CCP lens. And that, again, is part of this narrative game that we play, where they're going to try to use applications like this to further that narrative.
Yeah, 100%. I think it's... like you say, there's elements of intelligence gathering, enumeration necessarily of individuals, organizations, and as you mentioned, that collection. It becomes necessarily in some cases, you know, where we've the adage of, you know, as individuals representatively, we put a lot of information onto LinkedIn, social media platforms. And in this case, it kind of feels like, again, we're just giving that information away necessarily. And it's being used really against us in terms of some collection activities. And even in some cases, it could be used to, I'll use this word, and you'll correct me, but it, a profile necessarily, or profiling activity and certain utility. And again, what type of interests are you necessarily utilizing the large language model for? Oh, that can be easily crafted into either... you know, multiple elements of information campaigns in terms of what's returned in the future, as well as building different narratives that could be used in different campaigns as well against the individual. So I think that's an interesting paradigm. And it's, you know, we have, I think in our industry, we're very much of the new tool, the new blinking lights. Yes, let's get involved. Let's get it utilized. And I think there's certain cautions in the space. So Ryan, it's, you know, leading us down a path of looking at security and privacy assessments, right? As we're looking to integrate, no matter the model itself, really, doesn't matter if it's foreign or whatever model. And Tim, you had mentioned this is, but when we're using an external AI model, large language model, whatever it happens to be, we have to think a little bit differently and also apply certain controls versus the rush to the cutting edge. What do you think about that, Ryan? Does that make sense?
Definitely. And I mean, again, looking at the context of the CCP's data collection practices and the fact that DeepSeek is a Chinese-owned company, you know, that's a one particular security risk that you have to look into. Again, going back to those vulnerabilities, that's a big concern also for individuals. You know, it is very common for people to input personally identifiable information into chatbots. You know, there's also an ongoing issue of employees inputting sensitive information into chatbots without their employer's knowledge. And, you know, we wouldn't want one, a foreign adversary to access that information, or two, for that information to come out in a data breach. If, you know, a cyber threat actor that is financially motivated found a vulnerability in the system that they were able to exploit. And again, going back to that, point that, you know, AI models are really treasure troves of data, a lot of different threat actors are going to be looking at it as a high value target. So that makes, you know, making sure that these systems are secure even more important.
100%. The way I'm looking at the, you know, the utility of these respective models and, utilization, integration, things of that nature, really has, and I keep using this term, and it's multidimensional, because I think it's important to understand that as we utilize the tool, and respectfully, it's, you know, necessarily generating metadata from how we're using it or where it's necessarily installed. But then there's also the data collection element of how we're using it and interacting with it. And I find that that's quite an interesting approach, because there are, certain elements or users of respective systems that can use these types of capability really in different ways. And it feels like that this leads us down a path of, well, let's go the browser route just really quickly. We'll dive down there. So what are you interested in? You know, you're going on to Amazon and you're shopping for certain activity. Okay, well, now maybe I can generate a spear phishing email that maybe can get you to click those types of things. But now we're having conversations and generating content that's not just a simple search, but an interaction. I think that takes on a different aspect and representatively has a different value. And so, Ryan, I love the way you put that these are high value targets, because it feels like enriched data about the individual thought processes, the way they think. And it's necessarily, you could respectfully build elements of a psychological profile. So I go back to the profiling again, Tim, as part of representatively this narrative of building individual constructs that are focused on individuals. And again, we could look at this being a high value target, but also individuals being high value targets. This leads us down some interesting paths that, you know, 2-3 years ago, Tim, I would have said this is fiction. Kind of feels like we're turning that into a reality. Is that tracking in your mind?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it is one of the things that's going to be studied for years, is how rapidly all of this has become part of the public. I mean, everywhere you turn these days, AI is being thrown into applications. Now, whether it's actually AI or somebody taking an existing feature and slapping the AI sticker on it, you know, that's up for a healthy debate. But I do think, you know, your point about individuals and profiles, that's really important to think about, again, not just for DeepSeek, but for any AI platform. Ryan mentioned we've had data breaches in the past. DeepSeek got a bunch of data breaches within a week of it being released to the public. And we've seen in the past how seemingly benign applications have actually been used for some interesting purposes. Strava, which is a fitness app, is a really great example, where folks were able to use the geolocation data from a fitness app to map out military bases, to find sensitive installations, to track high-profile figures within the United States and elsewhere. And when you think about these chatbots, I'm sure many of us have had very interesting conversations with them. Kind of brings me back to the days when Siri came out, and you know, you might have children around a Christmas tree, and the first thing they're doing with their new Siri is, you know, yelling some four-letter words at it just for giggles to see what would happen. But with ChatGPT, you've got your username attached to it. You've got your computer's information attached to it. Are you very comfortable knowing that your name, your email address, your phone number, and your chat history are on Chinese servers and may someday be leaked and exposed to the world, showing everyone just exactly what you were saying to this chatbot when it came out and what you were really interested in looking at? You know, we live in the golden age of data. We are constantly seeing stories about people's exploits online being made public. And this represents just one more frontier where there is just huge potential. Sean, you mentioned it perfectly. Those profiles to build on people to get a sense of their habits. If you're thinking about targeting for cyber espionage or even for targeting of critical infrastructure, learning about the people who are in charge of those systems or your specific targets, this again represents another great data collection point. And thanks to the fact that it's on Chinese servers, on Chinese soil, it makes it a lot easier for them to just go ahead and access that data.
I'd like to mention too, like, as part of the larger debate about generative AI and threats related to threat actors leveraging it, you know, a wide range of threat actors are recognizing the utility of generative AI platforms as an emerging technology that they can use to enhance their operations. You know, you have state-sponsored influence operations that are using it to generate content like images, text for long form news articles, for social media comments. You have cyber criminals who are looking at these platforms and using it to ask questions to help with malware development, using it to craft messages for social engineering campaigns. And I mean, we had a pretty recent example too with the Cybertruck explosion that occurred on New Year's Day, where the threat actor behind that actually used ChatGPT to conduct research prior to the explosion, you know, asking questions related to, you know, how many explosives he needed to cause the explosion, and questions along similar lines there. So all of that just goes to show, you know, it, the use of generative AI is not siloed to specific threat actor profiles, and a lot of different types of threat actors are kind of experimenting with it and trying to see how they can use it to enhance their operations, which again goes towards that point, speaks towards that point where the fact that researchers were able to so easily get by whatever safeguards DeepSeek did or did not have, why that is also an issue to kind of keep in mind.
Oh, definitely. The utility, and again, that's why I think there's so many different aspects to building out and, you know, representatively in your worlds, that the threat modeling element of this is maybe, again, I'll ask you the question, is this potentially changing the way you're starting to look at adversarial activity, and also both the utility of utilizing the capability yourselves as well as how it's being used? In some cases, I think, you know, looking at what DeepSeek has to offer is kind of building up some of the representative skills to understand how would I use it, you know, let's put our adversarial hat on. And then I think that helps inform you potentially in terms of determining, okay, so we know that there's now a new element or a new trick, a new tactic in the space that's being used. What are our defensive postures? How are we going to let a wider community know? And I think that's interesting, Tim, because the velocity of change here, you mentioned it's going to be studied. I think it's so fast, and the reaction time necessarily the both you have, I think is, you may need AI to enhance necessarily to keep up with that velocity, but again, it's maybe a catch-22 in that space. But does that track, Tim, in your mind as you're starting now to see differentials in that space, and this velocity is, you know, we've got a lot to study and a lot to work with?
Yes, absolutely. You know, you see threat actors all the time trying to figure out how to use this technology. And part of that is them trying to keep up with it just as much as us, because there's always a new model, there's always a new thing to try and figure out what you can do with it. And I think, you know, if you go out a little big picture, if you think about our national security on this geopolitical chessboard, this rapid change is also something that needs to be addressed. We had the recent conversation surrounding TikTok and the divestment or the ban or whatever you want to call it, and all of that. But I think you see how the release of DeepSeek, the release of Red Note, all of those speak to a need for us to address this security risk at a broader level. Are we going to be very reactionary, you know, trying to have app by app divest or be banned? Or are we going to take a more holistic approach to this very real threat of legitimate applications? These are not malicious applications. They are legitimate applications available on an app store. But underlying them, there is a nefarious purpose, and that purpose is data collection in order to usurp the United States as the leading world power and give the CCP an advantage in a future conflict. That's, you know, a question for people at a much higher level than us here, but it is an important one that needs to be addressed, and it's one that will continue to be something for network defenders as well to think about. You know, you don't just have to guard against the malware and the hackings and all of that stuff. You now have to think about, am I allowing DeepSeek on my work phone? Am I allowing DeepSeek on my company's network? How am I going to combat this legitimate application, but one that does pose a very real security threat?
Oh, 100%, 100%. And, you know, Ryan, we've seen executive orders. I mean, one of the problems there is trying to keep up and, you know, whether that's going to be dictated through policy or through representative requirement. We just saw, you know, I think $500 billion investment from OpenAI and Oracle and SoftBank with, you know, keeping us at that pace. And then the following week, oh, well, we did this for $1 million and, you know, it's the same level of performance and it's going to be a heck of a large language model that comes out of half a trillion. But it's interesting to see that, Ryan, develop, because we've got EU AI controls. We've seen US executive orders on AI. I think there's a push. Obviously, we see the investment. Does that change necessarily when we're thinking about from a broader holistic perspective from security, what our reactions could be, and necessarily that we see such a huge utility? And Tim, you mentioned it before, if it's not got AI enabled on it, it's not a true product in this current market, right? It has to have AI because it's just not going to compete. Does that change aspects of necessarily threat assessment or where we think we see controls being built holistically at a kind of a governmental or policy-driven level?
I mean, I think at the policy level, the big kind of debate is going to be how we approach kind of controls around these AI apps or other types of applications. You know, I think we've seen with RedNote and DeepSeek, we could potentially kind of have a piecemeal approach where as these applications and platforms come out, we ban them kind of one by one. Or, you know, there could be the development of an overarching policy, just kind of dealing with any sort of application that houses their data in China, where there is that risk of the Chinese government accessing that information. Those are conversations way above my head. We have to kind of see how those conversations go. But at least in the meantime, you know, individual organizations can form their own acceptable use policies and conduct their own risk assessments and create lists of approved software to kind of limit these risks, at least internally for them.
100%. Because what it leads me to, and it's not the same. There's some elements, respectfully, that I both kind of want you to weigh in, but we've seen kind of similar elements in privacy, and we could go back to the Privacy Act of 1974, but we've really started to see states take ownership of respective privacy control followed. You know, GDPR helped set a tone that California first started, and it seems, are we going down representatively that route when we're looking at the integration of such capability and technologies? And we've seen the executive order on AI. I think in, relative elements, there's going to be either a structured approach to the utility and research and the build out. But I think, Ryan, you make a very, very important point, very strong point here, is organizations need to contextualize for their use case. In a lot of cases, some are going to be very risk averse and have, kind of a very appropriate response to certain activity. And some are going to embrace necessarily a new capability or an open source element that they get to either integrate, contribute to, control, manage, regardless of territoriality, representatively of where that data is going to be stored, processed, managed, and respectfully controlled, is very, very interesting. And it's one, like you say, there are certain policies that could be enacted, at much higher levels. But I think the most important thing that we could necessarily contribute to that is the actual contextual use of these models. In some cases, that gets lost representatively on trying to build out, very holistic, very broad strokes, as it were, to elements of control, management, or understanding. And I think here we need to really assess utility as well as potential misuse, because I just see such a broad aspect of misuse in the AI space, because there is way more engagement. We could do, I'll do the browser to large language model comparison again. We could have Google Docs, right? And we can grab information and necessarily enumerate certain things, but let's multiply that by 100 and utilize an AI-enabled large language capability changes that dynamic and really then enhances a need to either here are the restrict requirements on building kind of an ethics engine that this has to run in, or representatively your integration has to do it in a way such that you build or can contribute to the control of the AI itself. And we see talk of hallucinations, right, and biases. And I think in this space, when we see, and we may not be able to understand the, I use a big term here, but the sovereignty necessarily of what, how that model was trained, how it learns necessarily, can contribute to, you know, information campaigns that are going to have different dynamic effects, and really something we need to address. And so, you know, I see a positive contribution. And again, obviously, experts like yourself being able to look at this from really different lenses of both utility as well as protection. And I think that's important. I think these are lessons that need to be learned very quickly. Again, we've talked about velocity, and then that's something that we could contribute to those making larger, more holistic decisions. And with that, we'll be right back after this quick break. Are you a US state, local, tribal, or territorial government organization? Well, if so, you know how remote and hybrid work models make it really difficult to protect your endpoints and manage your vulnerabilities. Well, this is where CIS Endpoint Security Services can help. Now available exclusively to US SLTTs like yours, CIS ESS deploys directly on endpoint devices to help you identify, detect, respond to, and remediate endpoint security incidents and alerts. Now, it works in partnership with our 24/7/365 CIS Security Operations Center, which analyzes threat detections and notifies you of actionable endpoint security incidents, all within 5 minutes. Now, ESS also comes with add-on and standalone capabilities that provide real-time insight into vulnerability and mobile devices, including those of subordinate organizations you oversee. So strengthen your endpoint defenses today by visiting cisecurity.org.
Thank you. And let's jump back into the episode.
So Tim, we'll finish off with a couple thoughts from you, and then we'll move over to Ryan. In this space, are there any thoughts that you would leave the audience with in terms of how to approach newer technologies in the space? Is there something you would say before you, before you engage, go check, or at least reference some material of a trustworthy nature before you install? Any thoughts there?
Absolutely. I mean, rule number one: always be cautious when you're integrating a new system, a new technology, a new app. You know, especially one controlled by a foreign adversary. It's bad enough sometimes, some of the data that US-based companies collect in some of these applications that we use, and we may not be sure what happens there. It's even worse when it's an adversary overseas with a history of targeting us, and now we're handing them a huge amount of data. But, you know, luckily, when we're talking about these models and the data and everything, there's actually a great way already to assess the risk and the policies and the procedures in place. They're called the CIS controls. They're a great example of a framework that you can use. Yes, they were not written with AI in mind. Maybe I'll trademark that phrase. But they work so well because they're very, very flexible. For example, you have CIS control number 3. That deals with data protection, inventorying your data management process. A lot of care in that control about how we protect our data. And the same should apply to uploading it. For example, you take all of this time to make sure your data is secure on your systems. The bad guys can't get to it. Do you really want to upload it to a foreign-backed artificial intelligence application, or even a domestic one? CIS Control 16, Application Software Security. A lot of steps here to ensure third-party software is secure and can safely house your data. Same steps should apply when you're considering the risks of a foreign-backed generative AI platform. And my final thought here is, I know there's been a lot of talk about this AI, there's been a lot of fear out there about it and what that means for the future of the United States and our development of AI. And I would just caution everyone, you know, a lot of this has been hype. The price tag in particular caught people's eyes. I know this may be hard to believe, but it's possible they lied about that, that it may have cost them a little bit more than what they're actually saying. And this is to be expected. We were never going to dominate the game in AI. We were never going to be the only ones that had it. This happens any time in history where there's a new technology and there's a bit of a race between competing powers to ultimately win the day. You saw the same thing with the development of the atom bomb. It was inevitable others would be able to grab that technology. AI is the same way. We're in a race, and it's still important that we're investing in this technology. We're taking it seriously. We're learning lessons. We're having discussions about the privacy and the data and everything about it, because ultimately that puts us, the United States, in a much stronger position to dominate this field and dominate the future of it. And at the end of the day, we have to have our eyes on that prize, the finish line, and not get caught up worrying about developments that occur along the way.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Any final thoughts from you, Ryan?
So, I mean, one of the main things I would say for any individual or organization looking to use any of these types of platforms is, number one, look at the privacy policy. What data is being collected and where is that data being stored? And also look into any security risks related to the platform. And is that data secure? Where are they sharing that data? Is it data that they're collecting? Is it data that they're sharing with other partners? Ask yourself, is this a platform that I want to input personal information or proprietary information into, if that's one of the use cases you're looking to use it for? I would advise against that. Again, these platforms are a treasure trove of data, a high value target. So I would advise against inputting any of that type of data into these platforms, even if you do decide to integrate them in your workflow. Mainly just be aware of those risks and make sure you conduct a full assessment before integrating any of these platforms into your workflow.
Wonderful. Caution, caution, caution. I love it. Tim, Ryan, thank you so much. I really appreciate you being on the show. Fantastic information. I think there's a lot more to uncover here. I think this is the tip of the iceberg representatively. And as things unfold, I definitely want you both back so we can assess some more risk and some more great advice. And thank you to our audience. Remember to subscribe in all the usual ways. Catch us on YouTube at The CI Security. And with that, we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to the podcast today.
The thoughts and opinions expressed by our podcast guests are solely theirs and do not necessarily reflect those of CIS.
Tune in on Wednesdays for a new episode. And in the meantime, visit our website at cisecurity.org.
Together, we'll continue our efforts of creating confidence in the connected world.